Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and Professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. The topic of his presentation will be Dying Well, Getting the Best Care Possible Through the End of Life. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Dr. Byock has been involved in hospice and palliative care since 1978. At that time, he helped found a hospice home care program for the indigent population served by the University Hospital and County Clinics of Fresno, California. He is a past president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. During the 1990s, he was a co-founder and principal investigator for the Missoula Demonstration Project, a community-based organization in Montana dedicated to the research and transformation of what is possible nationally. From 1996 to 2006, he served as Director for Promoting Excellence in End-of-Life Care, a national grant program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Byock has authored numerous articles on the ethics and practice of hospice, palliative, and end-of-life care. Here now to introduce the program is Cindy Kugler, Director of the Center for Faith Studies.
I hope you have taken time already to read Dr. Byock's biographical information in your program. It is astonishing, and he is obviously and amazingly accomplished. Here at Countryside, we often talk about finding our own sweet spot, doing work passionately, work that is an expression of our own sense of mission and purpose. I don't think I overreach when I say that I see just that in our presenter's biography and his successes. Please help me welcome Dr. Ira Byock.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you all for being here. I'm humbled to be among you all. And to be part of this series on faith studies, looking at the history of it and the speakers yet to come, speakers who have been here, it's truly an honor to be among you, so thanks. I want to start with actually a few disclaimers. when you come to a city like this, a couple of things happen. First, if you've written a book, and particularly if you've had the audacity to have the title of the talk look a lot like the title of a book, people assume that you've come to sell your book. That's actually not true. I don't mind that you buy a book, certainly, or borrow it and read it. I wrote it to be read. But in fact, I'm not here to sell the book, in all honesty. It would be more accurate to say that I wrote this book to give this talk. Because I learned a long time ago, sort of as a student of change and social change particularly, that if you feel strongly about something you want to say into the society, into the culture, you think there's things that we need to act on collectively, you darn well better write a book. Because if you don't write a book, nobody asks you to come and give talks, frankly. Nobody asks you to be interviewed on TV or radio. And I passionately feel like we have stuff we need to talk about as a country, as a society, as a national community. There's a crisis in the way we care for people and the way people die still today. And this is one crisis we could actually fix. So we have work to do. I'll talk more about that in a moment. So, I wrote this book, and it, frankly, it's worked. I've been on, NPR, and, some people have told me they've heard me. I've been, I did Talk of the Nation, and I did On Being with Krista Tippett, and I've done all sorts of regional NPR stations. I was even on Fox and Friends. and so that's why I'm here. The other thing that I want to say as a disclaimer is I don't consider myself to be an expert in any of this stuff. I'm not just saying that, really. I'm not an expert in death and dying. I get introduced occasionally like that. Just think how odd that sounds to me. I just want to be clear, I've never died. that I know of, we may need to talk later, but I'm a serious student of this time of life. Like so many of you who I've already met, who work in healthcare and certainly in hospice and palliative care, I hang out with people who are seriously ill and facing the end of life on an almost daily basis, and I have for many years. And I've approached my care for people by asking them to help me understand what the world looks like through their eyes so that I can be a better doctor and, frankly, so that I can be a better teacher. So I'm a serious student of this time. Beyond that, I'm here as a clinician, you know, and doctor, but I'm so aware that, you know, I'm a son, I'm a husband, I'm a brother, I'm a father, I just became a grandfather. How cool is that? And that this is one topic where really all of us are in this together. We all have a stake in this. So although I'm here to speak to you as somebody who does this work day in and day out and has thought about it and tried to, you know, have a positive influence on the way people are cared for and the way our society responds to people who are seriously ill and dying and the way our culture understands it, my experience is really, in fact, being among you and not talking to you, but frankly, hopefully soon talking with you. We live in unprecedented times. This crisis that I alluded to is happening through no ill intention on anybody's part, but we do indeed live in unprecedented times. You know, and partly it's because of the prowess of modern medicine. There are more old people than young people on the planet now, or are about to be, than ever before in human history. That's happening in our country as well. This is unprecedented. Medicine has been part of that. Certainly public health and sanitation and lots of the you know, macro things that we've learned and applied through science has helped a lot. But modern medicine has helped us stay alive. We used to die quickly of so many things that nowadays we live with for, you know, years, sometimes decades. Congestive heart failure used to take people away. The first time they had, you know, pulmonary edema, they would die. Dropsy, they called it. Cancer used to be an acute illness. You'd feel a lump under your above your shoulder or under your armpit or in your groin. And, you know, within about 3 weeks, you'd been dead of some clot or infection or some complication of a cancer. Nowadays, we're now curing almost 60% of solid tumors. And for those we can't cure, people live with them often for many months, sometimes years, and for most of that time quite well. I could go on and on. Renal failure. Nowadays, we have multiple renal replacement therapies, including for some people, renal transplants, which have become almost routine. It's hard to even say that, but it's true. And we can go on and on and on. Pharmacology, physiology, molecular biology, genetics, proteomics, immunology, surgery, microsurgery, nanotechnology. You could go on and on and on. Stuff, you know, new words that we've had to develop to keep pace with the advances. Now, that's really great, and I, for one, celebrate the prowess of medicine to fight disease and keep us alive. The problem is we have yet to make even one person immortal. What we have done is invented chronic illness. It's really an invention of the latter part of the 20th century, and we've made it harder to die than ever before in human history. People are sicker before they die than ever before in human history. That sounds so weird when you first hear it. But indeed it's true, because we used to die quickly of the first, you know, life-threatening problems. Even an appendicitis not too long ago would take people away. Anything before antibiotics, my parents used to talk to me about it. Antibiotics coming into being in the late 1930s and 1940s, and people coming home from the hospital with things that would have killed them earlier. Nowadays, we doctors talk about burdens of illness, the burden of illness. People collect comorbidities, you know, Many of the people that I care for and our team cares for day in and day out have 3 or 4 diagnoses that would have killed them. Now, I don't think this is bad, and that's not the problem in and of itself. It's, in fact, cause for celebration because life is precious. And, oh, by the way, we're all going to be dead a long time. So, you know, I celebrate the prowess of medicine and use it in my practice and, frankly, in our personal and family lives. But if we're going to use it well, if we're going to give people the best care possible, we need to look beyond simply the fighting of disease. Nowadays, you know, if you ask people in any public survey, where do you want to be when your time is coming? About 70% in most surveys, no lower than that, say, I want to be home if possible, surrounded by people I know and love and who love me. Ironically, still, about 70% of Americans die in institutions. Either hospitals, where 50% or more of people die, 20% of Americans now die during a hospitalization that involves an ICU stay, or in nursing homes, where about 30 to 40% of Americans die. And where hospital deaths regionally, it's a lot of variation, where hospital deaths have gone down, nursing home deaths tend to go up. 20% of Americans dying in ICUs, think about that. Dying is hard, but it needn't be this hard. I've been thinking more and more about the limitations of imagination and how that, in a very tangible way, limits our ability to address and solve this very human problem. When someone we love is seriously ill, on the one hand, we cannot imagine anything worse than the person we love dying. But many of you know from your personal lives, and many of you who work in healthcare know from your practices, that there are worse things than having someone you love die. Most basically, there's having someone you love die badly, suffering as he or she dies. And maybe the only thing worse than that is realizing sometime later that much of the person suffering was unnecessary or could have been ameliorated or avoided. On the other hand, when someone we love is seriously ill and their life is threatened, we cannot imagine anything positive that could be possibly associated with this time in their life and their passing. But many of you know, certainly from your personal lives, and some of you who work in hospice at least recognize from the work that you do, that there are things of value that are possible, that are available to us as individuals and as families, as close friends, during this time of life we call dying. And that's not in any way to romanticize the experience of illness and dying, because let's face it, it's terrible. I almost said something bad, but I realized I'm in a church. It's unwanted. It's gritty often. But in fact, despite the sadness and tragedy that illness and dying so often represents, there are things of value, a chance to say and do things that would be left undone, a chance to express oneself, to celebrate life and relationships. I don't like the phrase good death. It's the one that's used, and clearly I have to accept that it's in the culture. But I think it disserves us. For one thing, it perpetuates the confusion between death, which is beyond life, a lifeless state, and dying, which is a part of living. You know, so often you'll see in the newspaper or magazine or even in medical literature the word death used when really the word dying would have fit much better. I wrote a book called Dying Well, and I chose the title for that book really carefully. When you first hear that phrase, dying well, most people hear the word well as an adverb, you know, modifying the experience of dying, the process of dying. Fair enough. Grammatically correct and useful. But it's more provocative, I think, to our cultural mindset to hear the word well as an adjective. You know, can someone die well? Can a person be well within themselves during this period of time, this time in their lives, when we would consider, at least in retrospect, that they were dying? Well, of course they can. You know, we're more than our bodies. You know, and the fact that we are mortal doesn't mean that we have to be pathological during the last days of our life. In fact, you know, in my work, in doing the hard work of taking good care of people, using the physiology and pharmacology to care well for people, I often, and I, our team, I think, frees them to be able to say and do the things that matter most at this point in time, to explore and their own priorities, and to be well within themselves during this last part of life. I say this because the only way that I know to convey this really is by telling stories. Stories help us to expand the realm of our imagination. So often people say, I can't imagine what else I can do. But in telling stories, we make it possible to collectively imagine something beyond suffering, or if we need to, approaches to suffering, clinical and also social, that we might not have been able to think of without those stories. Part of what I want to do as I travel and give interviews and, yes, write, is to expand what people consider to be possible, individually in their own lives, certainly those of us who are professionals clinically, but also collectively. We have to imagine how we can become well as a culture, because I think our values are great. I think America is a loving national community. But we have no way, no idea, how bad things are and how much better they could be. I chose the title of this book, The Best Care Possible, because it's the only thing I know that every single person wants. When you or someone you love is seriously ill, you want the best care possible. Now, what that means, of course, is different from one person to another. A person can have three different serious illnesses, congestive heart failure, a recent stroke, maybe lung cancer. Three people might have the same exact diagnoses, and what the best care would be for them would be different. This is not a one-size-fits-all situation. But I do know the process of decision-making that can help us delineate for each individual what the best care would be for them at this point in time and going forward. It's called shared decision-making. Now, that's come a long way in the time that I've been practicing medicine. When I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, shared decision-making happened when the doctor shared his decisions with you, if you were lucky. But these days, we realize that patients and their families are already expert in their values and their preferences and priorities, and we in healthcare, hopefully as doctors, are already expert in the medicine, in the diagnostics, in the therapeutics, the physiology, pharmacology, surgical, interventional therapeutics as well. And together, what the process of shared decision-making is simply to map people's values and preferences onto the particularity of their health condition, their multiple diagnoses and morbidities, and apply their priorities to the available therapeutics in service of achievable healthcare outcomes, right? So it's individual personal values and preferences applied to the conditions, clarifying achievable and desirable goals. Now, not all desirable goals are achievable, right? Again, we've yet to make the first person immortal, so, I can't promise eternal life. That comes to a different profession. But I can, ensure that people will get the best care possible on their own terms. And that's, that is not only achievable, it's scalable. We can teach this. This is what palliative care does day in and day out. I work in a 400-bed acute care hospital. a team of 15 people doing palliative care. What we do day in and day out is to help clarify goals of care, help people develop. It's not just individualized plans of care, it's personalized plans of care. And this comes to probably the most important point I'll make all night. If I've learned anything in this process in the 34 years that I've been doing this work, it is that the fundamental nature of serious illness and dying is only partly medical. Clearly, individuals who are seriously ill have medical problems. It's almost, a tautology. But the fundamental nature of illness and dying is personal, intensely so, profoundly so, for both the individual and family. So the best care has to incorporate the best diagnostics and therapeutics. But that's not sufficient, because the best care has to take care of the person who is physically ill, as well as their families. It is possible to do. Of course, what I'm talking about is part of the fact that to give the best care possible, it takes preparation. And that takes having the conversation. Oy. Just to disclose, I'm an unpaid advisor to the Conversation Project, something that Ellen Goodman, a syndicated columnist, has been doing. They were recently on Diane Sawyer's ABC News. It's an effort to encourage people simply to have the conversation in their own families about what they value and what they think they would want in circumstances if they were seriously ill. It's a part of a national movement to have people begin to not only talk to one another, which is the most important thing, but to give people authority to speak for you if you're unable to speak for yourself. These things called advance directives. You know, April 16th, coming up again, is National Healthcare Decisions Day. We chose April 16th because, it's death and taxes, right? So every April 16th, there'll be public service announcements and encouragement and news stories about having the conversation and giving somebody permission to speak for you. I have an advance directive, and so does every adult in my family, because we think it's part of giving one another the best care possible. It's not morbid. It's a way of taking care of my family at a future time when I may not be able to speak for myself, but they're going to be left holding the bag, having to struggle with decisions about my treatment and care. I can't stop that. But I can give them, first, clear authority to speak for me so that no ethics committee needs to get involved, or no, heaven forbid, a court or legislature needs to get involved, as happened in the Schiavo case we saw, a true national tragedy. And I've said in my advance directive what I think I would want, so that perhaps I'm lifting a little bit of the burden from their shoulders when the time comes. If I have a serious stroke later tonight, or car accident, head injury later tonight, I know that my wife and two daughters are going to struggle about those decisions. I want to provide them as much support as I can. I ask this of everyone in that I encounter as a patient, because it's part of protecting them and serving their family. By the way, my two daughters in their late 20s and early 30s have advance directives. You know how that happened? Remember the spring of the Schiavo case? What was it, 2006, I think? Around May of that year, each of them, they live separately, they live on the West Coast, called me up and said, "Dad, what do you want for Father's Day this year?" I want you to have an advance directive, because the worst thing I can imagine is for one of you to be seriously ill, unable to speak for yourself. But that's actually not the worst thing. The worst thing is to have that happen and not be able to make decisions out of our loving care of you, to have an ethics committee or court get their nose in our business. So I said to them, if tragedy strikes our family, could we at least keep it in the family? The best care possible, of course, takes good doctors. And doctors are loving, caring people. It doesn't... I know that the The media and portrayals don't often show that, but let me tell you, doctors are well-motivated people. I teach medical students and residents and fellows these days. These are people who are passionate about serving other human beings. They are motivated first and foremost by love, frankly. But we really tend to make it hard for them to express that. In fact, our healthcare system is a disease treatment system more than a caring system. And that's what we teach them. If you want to advance in medical education and practice, you better darn well be a good diseaseologist, good diagnostician and treater. And the stuff that we're talking about, the personal aspects of medicine, have successfully been degraded, frankly, by healthcare. It's nobody's fault, but it's happened in a zeal to be ever more objective and ever more scientific and evidence-based, all of which is good. We have inadvertently but undeniably stripped the personal from the medical, and that's not good. As a medical educator today, frankly, I have to tell you, I'm still failing the students that I teach. I work at one of the best medical schools in the country, I happen to think, Geisel Medical School at Dartmouth in New Hampshire. But we teach a lot of diagnostics and therapeutics. We still teach more obstetrics to medical students, 200 hours or more obstetrics to every medical student required than we do hospice and palliative care, shared decision-making, communication. It doesn't make any sense because these days, I mean, that curriculum distribution was set in place in the mid-20th century when doctors still delivered babies. Now, if a doctor delivers a baby, he or she has done a postgraduate residency in family medicine or OBGYN. So, you know, it's probably from a public health perspective not necessary for every medical student to have 200 hours of obstetrics. And, oh, by the way, the last time I checked, only about half of the population was at risk for an obstetrical experience. But the recent data suggests that 100% of Americans will eventually die. When I teach medical students these days, sometimes I ask them, you know, who's going into obstetrics? So, you know, usually three hands out of 100 or so go up. Who's going into palliative medicine? We'd be lucky if one or two hands go up. Okay. Now, who's going into internal medicine? Keep your hands up, please. Geriatrics. Any of the internal medicine subspecialties, cardiology, endocrinology, neurology, pulmonology, critical care. How about surgery? Surgical subspecialties, oncologic surgery, vascular surgery, cardiac surgery. Keep your hands up, everybody. All of you who have your hands up will be doing end-of-life care. We're just not going to teach you to do it. I feel this in a way of apology because we're setting them up to fail, and therefore they will then set up the society that they serve to fail. I can teach this stuff, by the way. It is not rocket science. But I can't do it in a lecture. I can't do it in one day. I need them on service. You know, medicine is still taught as a craft, as a guild. I need them to spend a couple of weeks with us. I need them. These days we have standardized patients. We hire actors to play patients in standardized roles. And it feels very real, by the way. And we then put medical students into these situations in highly mentored encounters. And then we videotape it and play it back and help them shape their behavior through it so they get a feel of how to have these difficult conversations, how to do shared decision making. It can be taught. We're just not doing it quite yet. The best care possible is possible, but it takes a functional health system. Oy. Or as my grandmother would say, oy veyasmir. I said earlier, our healthcare system is really a disease treatment system, but it's so seriously broken. You know, anybody who's interested, really, I encourage you to read Time magazine this week. Stephen Brill's brilliant journalistic exposition of the incredible costs of healthcare, unnecessarily soaring costs of healthcare, and how broken the system is. The system is not only far too expensive, it's fragmented. People get caught and feel like they get lost in the system. And it does often pauperize people for being seriously ill and not dying quickly enough. Bills and the cost of health care, again, shown brilliantly in Brill's article and told in the stories that I try to tell, shows that so much of America is suffering, so much of people who are seriously ill are suffering partly from purely imposed social stresses of the bills that they are paying and can't possibly understand, but is sucking away all of their life savings and the burden that they become to their families, a burden that in fact feels undignified to them. Indeed, health reform, the Affordable Care Act, takes a small step in the right direction, but we have far, far more long way to go in fixing the health care system, and it can be fixed. We do not have to ration health care to fix this system. We do not need more money in the health care system to do this right, but we need to reinvent how we spend that money, moving from just seeing pathology and diseases to seeing whole persons who have every right to live as long and as well as possible, but who will ultimately leave this life. Quality is not just about survival. It's also about quality of experience, quality of life, quality of relations with physicians and nurses, and quality of relationships with one another, friends and family. And that brings me to the next point, because the best care is possible, but it takes not only the best health care and a functional health system and good doctors, good science, it takes a family. You know that as well as I do. And I don't mean just family by marriage or bloodline, but family by that phrase, for whom it matters. We all matter to one another. Most of the time when I'm called to see, our team gets a call, we have an unbefriended patient in the ICU. Well, we go up and see the patient and learn about him or her. Before long, almost without exception, we find that the person's not exactly unbefriended. If you snoop around and do some detective work, there are people who matter to them and for whom they matter. Family is a verb. It has the substance of a noun, but it's all about mutuality, mutual responsiveness. Indeed, family caregiving is the backbone of healthcare for chronically ill people in America today. 61 million Americans are caring for a frail young person or elderly individual. 42 million Americans spend 18 or more hours a week in the process of family caregiving. The economic value of family caregiving is up to about $450 or $500 billion a year, dwarfing paid home health care, nursing home care. But family caregiving takes a toll these days. Family caregivers not only often give up money and their own financial well-being, but family caregiving takes a toll on people's health. In one study, there was a 60% higher mortality risk over 4 years of surveillance in family caregivers who reported high levels of strain in the process of caregiving. Those of us who work in family practice or palliative care or geriatrics nowadays talk about family caregiving as a diagnosis itself, because we know it takes a toll on people's well-being. On the other hand, the best assisted living model that I've ever encountered, and this will be familiar to some of you, is called an old married couple. Some of you may know some. But for every Harry, who has some Parkinson's disease, maybe what we call Parkinson's plus, a little dementia with Parkinson's disease, and maybe some prostate cancer and, some arthritis and just chronic pain, there's likely to be a Shirley who has high blood pressure and congestive heart failure and maybe some type 2 diabetes and maybe some macular degeneration and some osteoporosis and maybe some spinal stenosis, right? But Harry and Shirley are supporting one another. They fit together because they grew that way. Now, these days in America, we don't see Harry and Shirley unless one of them falls and breaks a hip or has a stroke. And then the healthcare system sees them all too clearly, and there's cost is no object. EMS is called. They go to the emergency department. They'll go to the hospital, the OR, or the ICU, and get the care that they need for the diseases that they have. And when one is ill, often the other becomes ill because that system collapses. Now, I tell you this because it doesn't need to be this way. We could imagine something better. If we dealt with the personal, not just the medical, we would see Harry and Shirley as a frail couple living alone in need of services. We'd get the throw rugs off of the floor so they didn't trip. We'd get the grab bars on the, you know, in the bathroom so that they wouldn't fall in the bathroom. We'd deal with them as whole persons and the dyad of a couple. And more than likely, the studies suggest that both Harry and Shirley's quality of life would rise and they would live longer. The area under the curve of valuable life for both of them would likely increase, and costs would fall. Why don't we do that? In fact, it's a rhetorical question because there's no ill intention, but our systems are not set up to see them as human beings. We only see their diagnoses, their morbidities. Caregiving is hard, but it needn't be this hard. In fact, the best care takes a community that supports the families within that community. And community, like the word family, is a verb. Community is about being responsive to one another's needs. In a community, your well-being matters to me. This congregation, I have a strong sense, is such a community where the members care for one another. It's not just altruism, it's healthy living. Now, in that process, one has to give up a little bit of something. You give up privacy. But I got to tell you that we've conflated Jeffersonian democracy and individualism, which works really well in the body politic, with what healthy communities look like for human beings. In healthy communities, your well-being matters to me. Faith communities are one place where, throughout the geography of our country, we could begin to take back this difficult time of life. So too are workplace communities. Schools are communities, apartment complexes, service clubs like the Rotary and the Lions and the Elks and on 4-H clubs, book clubs, all of these things are communities. Sometimes I have several websites where I answer letters, and people say, Dr. Bayak, I'm in my, you know, 60s, and I'm worried about the future, and I wonder if you have any advice for somebody like me thinking about and planning for the future. My first answer is, get yourself a family. Because in families, we care for one another. And if you don't have a family, and I'm not suggesting anybody goes out and gets married on for this basis or adopts somebody, though both are very good things to do. But if you don't have a family and you're not likely to get a family, get yourself a community. And invest in that community now. Right? Because in communities, we care for one another. And if you have a family, this is a good time to reinvest in that family. If there are things and intentions in that family that are keeping you apart, consider challenging your assumptions that it won't ever get better. Think about mending and tending relationships now. What I've learned years ago is that in faced with mortality, sometimes the indiscretions or the transgressions that have divided us begin to look small in comparison to the bonds which unite us. The most essential community program I've ever heard of are called RUAC programs. One of them started, I think, right around here. RUAC stands for R-U-O-K. It's a program of simply calling people up once a day, frail elders living alone. It can be based in schools where fourth graders call up frail elders living alone. once a day in the morning in homeroom to just check, are you okay? How's your day? This program can save lives. Not only does it improve the quality of life of the frail elder, and I would suggest the young person making the call, but every once in a while, the call's not answered. And so we go out and find what's up. Why isn't, you know, Mrs. Jones answering the phone? So that she's not found down 2 days later in her kitchen. And finally, the best care possible takes love. We know that. You know, I hope it doesn't seem odd for a physician to say that, but love has always been the impetus of the caring professions. Historically, it was the initial impetus for forming the caring professions, and I gotta tell you, it is still the driving force today. I see it in the students. I see it in my colleagues. We whisper about it to one another because we're afraid we'll seem too sentimental if we say it too loud, but it's there. Love is not unethical. I have to say that because I'm giving a talk tomorrow called The Ethics and Practice of Loving Care. But when I say that to physician groups, you can see them, oh, did you hear what he said? You know, as if it had some sexual connotations. How bizarre is that? Love is a pure emotion. It's okay. So let me just shift gears and say, so what's stopping us? None of what I've said here is particularly revolutionary. You know, the fact is, we've lost our way. We've been pinned down by the culture war, I think. You can't have this conversation outside of these sorts of community groups. I can't talk in the body politic about this. Politicians or elected officials avoid topics of end-of-life care like the plague, like they were radioactive. Because on the one hand, they're worried about the assisted suicide folks saying, what about death with dignity? We have a right to, you know, die with our boots and our makeup on. And on the other hand, people worrying about death panels or rationing. You'll see, if you look hard, or not that hard, you can Google me, and you'll see my name associated with death panels and with the culture of death, some fringy, far, far right social conservative groups have castigated even hospice and palliative care for promoting the culture of death. How offensive is that? You know, the fact is that we are the most pro-life segment of American society. You know, and I'm not talking about, I mean, we're the ones who show up when people are seriously ill and dying, when everybody else, in some sense because they have good sense, are running as fast as they can away from anything to do with illness, dying, death, or grief, we rush in. You know, but we're still fighting some weird, perverse battle that doesn't even apply. This is not about abortion or it has nothing to do with any of this. You know, physicians have always been inherently pro-life. We protect and preserve life, right? But if you want to affirm life, you have to affirm all of life. And that includes the times we call illness and caregiving and dying and grief. In fact, civilization is pro-life. We came together in antiquity to protect and preserve and honor and celebrate life. That's why we have guardrails on highways. If civilization wasn't pro-life, why would we do that? Why would we have fire departments? Why would we have public safety at all? Hazmat teams and, you know, I mean, really and truly, you know. So we have to get over this. Now, I happen to be ardently opposed to the legalization of physician-assisted suicide. There's great diversity in this society, and I'm not here to promote that stance. As a proud political progressive, though, I don't buy that people have a right to suicide. I think they have a right to health care. I think they have a right to, you know, good communication with doctors. I think they have a right to health care that doesn't pauperize them for being seriously ill and not dying quickly enough. But I'm not going to convince anybody. But what we can do, and part of why I've been traveling and speaking, is that I think We can acknowledge that we are a diverse society and that there are some things that we're not going to agree about, and that we're going to fight in the body politic and in referendums and in legislatures, as we should. But meanwhile, I believe that we are all, even my opponents in this discussion, basically loving, caring people, and that we already stand on high common ground. You know, I read a lot of sci-fi just for entertainment. It's my beach reading. In science fiction, when an asteroid is headed to Earth, people put their political differences aside. You know? And we see this in the real world when natural disasters occur. When Hurricane Sandy happened on the East Coast, people, you know, came together. They didn't say, "Well, who are you going to vote for? Wait a minute. I know that your house is, you know, on fire and the place is flooded, but where do you stand on these issues?" We even saw Chris Christie and Barack Obama come together. What a bromance that was. Right? And it's not because they suddenly love one another, hardly. They were actually coming together in face of a natural disaster to do what we elected them to do, to work together for the sake of the people in their communities, in our national community. I think that we're there, folks. I would submit that death is the natural disaster that confronts us all. So while we acknowledge our differences, and frankly, while we commit to continuing to contest the issues that we disagree on, could we please come together and work to address the roots of suffering in the United States among people who are seriously ill? Let me suggest that it can be done. We've done it before. We who have gray hair, we baby boomers, I see a number of my fellow boomers in the audience. We've done this before. When baby boomers were having babies in the late 1960s and early 70s, we took back the beginning of life. You know, when I was growing up, pregnancy and childbirth were medical events. I was born under general anesthesia. You know, when I was growing up, they didn't let fathers in delivery rooms. Are you kidding? It would have been unheard of. It would be like letting a husband into his wife's gallbladder surgery. It was just not going to happen. But when we boomers were having babies, we took it back. We said that pregnant women, the fact that pregnant women need expert attention for prenatal care and in labor and delivery does not define these experiences as being primarily medical. They are only partly medical. They are firstly profoundly personal for the individual, the woman, her baby, her family. And we demanded better prenatal care. Prenatal care changed dramatically. It went from just checking, you know, urine for protein and blood pressure to prevent preeclampsia or eclampsia to really looking at peak nutrition, exercise, you know, sexuality, prepared birthing, La Leche League for, you know, prepared for breastfeeding. And we taught husbands to be birth coaches. And things got dramatically better, right? In fact, the outcomes of prepared childbirth are better, measurably better than the outcomes of unprepared childbirth for everyone involved. Look how fast it changed. Within like 2 decades, it was dramatically different. By the 1990s, we were worrying if fathers weren't in the delivery rooms. What's up with that? You know, and I remember when this was happening because I was in medical school. So, you know, when it was happening, it wasn't driven by physicians, even enlightened physicians. They got on board. It was driven by citizen consumers who demanded better health care but also took back these individual experiences. And frankly, initially medicine resisted. They said, well, we can't let fathers in delivery rooms. They'll fall over. Didn't happen. Turns out it's safe. Let me suggest that a very similar process needs to happen around the care of people who are facing the end of life, serious illness, family caregivers, those who are dying and those in grief. We need to take it back. Yes, we need better medical care for people, better communication, better symptom surveillance, better symptom management, better quality of life assessments. We also need to assess and respond to family caregivers much better because they do have a diagnosis. Just being a caregiver is a diagnosis. And so often those caregivers are the Shirleys of the world who are already have their own health problems. We make their lives miserable. But we need to take it back. It's not all political. Mostly it's social and cultural, this process. But let me suggest that there are some policy measures that would help. First, I'll give you just two or three things. If I was to create a high common ground agenda that was authentically pro-life, but called a truce in the pro-dignity, pro-life kind of, you know, debacle, I would say, let's come together to significantly raise staffing levels of nurses and nurses' aides in nursing homes. You know, if you really want to protect people's dignity, make sure that there's enough staff so that someone answers the bell when your mother or father needs help in getting to the bathroom. Nothing erodes somebody's dignity more than not being able to get help when you need to get to the bathroom. Today, in our nursing homes, studies have shown that they're about half-staffed, about half of the recommended levels. I would like to see us at least double the amount of nurses' aides in nursing homes. People say, well, how are we going to pay for it? If you do it, and where it's been done, it's been shown that it actually decreases costs through the end of life, because if there's enough staff, you don't have to, that night nurse doesn't have to shift grandpa off to the hospital if he has a fever or becomes confused and starts yelling because he's in pain or just confused. Secondly, let's require medical schools to teach palliative and hospice care, end-of-life care, and all the component skills of communication and counseling, shared decision-making, pain management, at a level that we currently teach prenatal care and labor and delivery. If we just had parity with the beginning of life, things would be dramatically better. We wouldn't make everybody specialists. We don't need them to be. But it's time to say we cannot keep graduating a new generation of doctors who feel unprepared to have these conversations, who don't know what the eligibility criteria for hospice care is, who keep referring to hospice care way too late, who feel as awkward having these conversations with their patients as many of us do in our own families. Thirdly, don't you think it's time to dissolve the artificial, arbitrary Medicare requirement that people have to give up treatment for their disease in order to get hospice care for their comfort and quality of life and their family support? This was put into place in the early 1980s when it was assumed that it would be too expensive to provide hospice care and disease treatments. But the studies have shown that it's actually more expensive to force a terrible choice and force people to give up treatments for their cancer or congestive heart failure to get hospice care for their well-being and their family's comfort and quality of life. Because people, if you force them to give up treatments, they come to hospice care very late. You know, the median length of stay in hospice care has fallen progressively. It's now 19 days, where Congress intended us to have 180 days on average of hospice care. In hospice care, which is, you know, a brilliant system of care, we're not doing end-of-life care as much as brink-of-death care these days. This has to stop. So I've talked enough, but let me just suggest that Americans are a diverse people, a loving people, and we are a caring nation. Despite passionate differences and heated debates over social issues, we need to come together, advancing those values and goals that we share. Without anyone yielding an inch of moral ground, we could alleviate untold suffering, improve quality of life for seriously ill and dying Americans, and go a long way to fixing the sorry state of dying in America today. This is my fondest dream. And I thank you for all the work you're doing locally as a community in this community, in this church, and in the community of Omaha. And thank you so much for allowing me to come and share my thoughts with you today. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ira Byock, Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and professor at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. The topic of his presentation was Dying Well, Getting the Best Care Possible Through the End of Life. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.